Welcome to Demand and Desire, the art and science of branding. My name is Jez Frampton. I'm the Global Chief Executive of Interbrand. And in this edition, it's all about retail. Why do we buy? I took the time with two of my esteemed colleagues, Bruce Dybvad, the Chief Executive of Interbrand Design Forum and Interbrand Cincinnati, and Fred Richards, the Global Creative Director for Consumer Packaged Goods, to talk about retailing, packaging, the use of colour, why we choose things, how they make us walk around shops, and what it is that you really have to do to be successful in that ever-tightening retail environment. I think it would be fair to say that the retail industry is going through one of those important periods of its history. A little like the car industry around about 2 or 3 years ago, retail finds itself in a position where things are changing swiftly around it. The ground on which it stands is no longer as solid as it once was. Where bricks and mortar companies are being taken to the cleaners by their internet counterparts. Generally, what happens when industries find themselves standing on the precipice like this is what we might call innovation. Yes, quite simply, people work out what to do next in order to continue to attract our attention as shoppers and, more importantly, to attract our wallets. Let's take some time to talk to Bruce and Fred to find out some of the tricks of the trade and, of course, to find out that it's not as easy as it might sound to simply put a product on a shelf and hope that it might sell.
Well, Bruce Dybvad, I'm the CEO of both the Dayton and the Cincinnati office for Interbrand, and my entire career has really been focused on understanding consumers, their motivation, and creating environments that produce.
Fred Richards, Creative Director, Global CPG for Interbrand. Like Bruce, I'm actually motivated by the consumer in terms of how do brands resonate with them, not just in the shelf, but also in the home, and how can we make a better connection with them using design as a driver to build the business.
So we're here to really understand how people shop. In its broadest sense, this isn't just about understanding why we wander around the aisles of our local grocery store once a week. It's really about understanding how people think about it, how brands work, how design works, how people use research, all of these different things. There is a real mixture of art and science that goes into understanding how people do things and then actually being able to produce work in the form of physical stores or indeed packaging and promotions that operate within those so that people will actually buy your products. It's easier said than done, shall we say. Talk to me about, obviously we're in interesting times. Pretty much anywhere you are in the world, the economy is pretty high on the agenda for people. That must have an effect on the way that people think and the way that they shop. And the way the place you need to start is to understand consumer behaviour, isn't it? Fred, talk to me about how you think about it from a creative perspective.
I think about it in two ways. The first is how a consumer thinks about the brand. What's the picture that lives inside their head when they are writing a list? What are the attributes, the assets that they think about, not just for the brand itself, but the category, and then also the use afterwards. So we think about it in terms of borrowed memory structure and distinct memory structure, the assets of the brand in the mind, but then also category language and how they navigate the store. How do they find you? Because in times of financial strain, I think what we've all recognized is that people's wallets are being scrutinized like never before. So those decisions and having to spend money on a brand versus private label, that's a different investment now than it ever was before. What we like to talk about is a reflective society. So we've gone from a we society to a me society. And that is that everybody now is their own country or their own printing press in terms of how they have computers at home, and they have a voice and they're connecting with each other. They're not even connecting with the brand first of all, they'll connect with their friends or family and have a conversation about their purchase decision, and that is an influencer.
How are the big trends in environments, Bruce, and how people shop? Do you think people are changing the way that they behave?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, there's a lot of options that are available to people, the way that they acquire product and the way they interact with brands today. In terms of prior to going to a store, how people make choices about the brands, the lists they make, the things that are absolutely on their list as to what they're going to go in and purchase. And the way those choices are made are something that can only really be understood through really careful investigation of how those decisions get made. But then also, once you get into the retail environment itself, you know, you're delivering a brand experience. That brand experience is the differentiator that, you know, either bonds you or disconnects you with them as an organization. And I think every moment that can be put to work in terms of delighting the customer from the moment they come through the front door, from the parking lot for that matter, once they've chosen you, from the parking lot into the interior environment, and the way that you utilize their time, the way you help them find product, the way that navigation is done, the way you stimulate their senses in the environment, because it truly is equal parts, I think, of theater and presentation that makes a product come to life, and equal parts of understanding behavior and science and what really motivates purchasing.
You seem to be talking about, you know, the shopping process as beginning quite a long time before we even think about going to the store. So you talked about making lists, for instance. Do you look carefully about how people do that? I mean, Fred?
Yes, sure. So when we go to people's homes, that's we do these shop-alongs or live-alongs. That's one of the first things we're looking at, is we ask them to hypothetically write a grocery list. And one of the things that we first got to look for is, does the brand appear on the list or does the category appear on the list? So batteries would be an example. You think about the commodities. Are they writing Duracell or Energizer, or are they just writing batteries? And do they even write the size down? Most people still can't navigate the difference between a AA and a AAA, for example.
Right.
But then if the brand appears on the list, that's what we'll be looking for in the store, is how are they looking at that? And Bruce is absolutely right. The navigation begins before they even walk into the store. But when they enter the aisle, from 20 feet away, they're already starting to navigate very basic shapes, colors, forms, before they start reading the mandatory information that's on there about size, variant, flavor, etc., etc. They're looking for those. And that goes back to the assets I was mentioning earlier. Those basic forms, shapes, structures are already inside the head as a picture, which is being represented by words on a page, which happens to be a grocery list.
You know, we find that people have very systematic processes to making those choices and what actually writes out a list, how people do it. You know, they're inspired by the places that they use the product. So if it's in the laundry room, they think of certain products. If it's in the kitchen, they think of certain products. And that's really the precursor for how choices are made. The one thing that's very true, though, is that even once you're in the store, there's malleability in getting people to be convinced to try something else,
yeah,
or to suggestively implant an idea that might, you know, move a product into the basket rather than the one that you had initially tried. You know, the principal idea of how people choose, I mean, it happens way upstream in their life. They think about it, you know, as a, in very unique ways within their homes and how they use those products within their own space.
Yeah, I would add to that. I think that how we'd like to refer to that is loyalty beyond reason, where the brand resonates so deeply on such an emotional level based on the experience in the home when they get home, that price doesn't become a factor. It's actually about the brand and how they interact with it. So the three journeys are in the home writing a list, in the store, how can you ensure that they can find it so they're not being influenced by bundling or value propositions, etc., etc. They find you and they are loyal to you. And then how do they interact with that brand when they go at home? How does that brand deliver on its promise? And that's where you engage with all of the senses. The smell, the touch, the weight, the feel in the hand, the grip, the noise it would make, the fizz, the burp, the pop. All of those things are really, really important to a consumer, but they never appear on a client brief.
Let's spend a little bit of time talking about stores, because they're not just randomly thrown together, are they? There's an incredible science in understanding how people shop, how they move around within the space, and how you use the space to try and maximize the amount that we actually buy.
Absolutely. We've got you know, very careful orchestration of product that occurs on the inside of the space that just has to do with how somebody sees the category of merchandise that you are actually involved with as a retailer. So being able to take some of the things that can be, you know, create pictures and backdrops that are beautiful presentations, you know, sometimes fresh product. These are things that really pull out, like, all the senses, you know, sight, smell, sound. Leaves an impression relative to freshness and, like, quality of goods that kind of can permeate everything. In a typical grocery store where you use the perishables and the things that are fresh to maneuver people around the perimeter, and then through the center of the store where we have the runs of goods, being able to do seductive merchandising presentations that pull them into that space. Because literally, in a retail environment of that nature, the excitement is all around the perimeter, and you use them to run the racetrack. Right. And then you have to create compelling presentations within the gondola runs to literally lure people down the aisles to get them engaged with the category. And we have to give them reasons to go there. So effective merchandising that uses things like some of the stuff that Fred was talking about in terms of signposting and color, shape. Every category in a store like that, in that particular example, has a recognizable quality to it that actually creates a waypoint and a firm position in the store that somebody can begin looking for other products. So within detergent, for instance, it could be Tide. Within the soup category, it could be Campbell's. These are visual metaphors that almost create signposts within those aisles for people to get to and really effectively improve their wayfinding. We know from experience that when you provide consumers with effective wayfinding, where they can get to the product that they want quicker, they will return it to you an additional time spent in the retail environment, which is another opportunity to actually add product that wasn't preconceived into the cart.
That's interesting. So if I might, on average, take an hour to go around the store on a Saturday afternoon, if you made it more efficient for me to shop, I might think that I'd leave after 45 minutes, but the reality is that I'd probably still spend an hour, and I'd probably spend some more money too.
That's exactly right, because people have allocated time to whatever they do. And when you give them that time back, that turns into productive opportunity for a retailer.
Fred, there's a lot going on here, isn't there? From, you know, the role of design is not straightforward. So when you're thinking about how to make the product that you're working for really sing out on the shelf, you've got to consider the context of what's going on around people in the store. You've got to consider the proximity to competitive products. You've got to consider the attitude and mindset of the consumer and what's in their head in terms of expectations. How do you get through all of that?
It's a good question. I think actually, I'll start with, it's actually a very, very exciting time to be in branding right now. Mm-hmm. Because I think we used to be, as an industry, very siloed. As you know, your packaging, your advertising, your web, you have to think about this holistically now. And you have to think about how all of these component parts are going to come together. And Bruce is absolutely right. How can you entice people down that aisle? And some brands have a responsibility to be category captains for a particular category, and that actually grows the business for everybody. And then if you think about how the brand lives, as I mentioned before, in the hearts and minds of consumers, what are the pictures and how do you leverage all of these assets across all of the touch points? So if you have an advertising campaign that is cute and cuddly and funny, etc., that's all well and good. But if you can't remember the brand, and how many times have you had that conversation?
Yep.
Did you see that commercial last night? Wasn't it funny? What was it for? I don't remember. Then how much money was spent, wasted, that didn't drive the consumer to that purchase, which is, of course, the intent. Mm. So you have to work now with other agency partners to deliver a holistic vision for the consumer. And the consumer has to be at the center of the conversation now. So if you can understand what their motivations are and how they shop, that could be the starting point to unlock all of the other touch points. And then you can distill it down to some very basic component parts of the packaging. Because essentially that's the touch point that drives everything.
Yeah.
The consumer purchasing your product.
Actively reaching out.
How can you cut through the clutter to make that moment? Because there are certain assets on that packaging that should live everywhere.
Are there sort of cues or languages, I suppose, around design which help us to navigate around and understand what's the, you know, there seem to be quite distinctive ways in which, you know, cereal looks and which coffee looks, in which, you know,
every category has a language. Every category. It's the difference between buying milk and motor oil, for example. The last thing you'd want somebody to do is pour milk in their car, motor oil, and cornflakes in the morning. But they're very distinct. And cereal is a good example. The basic hierarchy is manufacturer, logo, top left-hand corner, dynamic type on an angle, reading at 45 degrees from left to right, some kind of cutesy character, milk pour, splash, bowl, bottom left-hand corner. That's it. That's the entire category. So if you can understand the category language and the architecture, the wireframe of that particular category, you can then start to discern how you can start respecting it, but also differentiating yourself. I think five gum, the gum category, is a very good example. Everybody else is horizontal, for spearmint, for example, everybody else is horizontal green and white.
Yes.
With bursting leaf backgrounds. And Five Gum is vertical, it's black with a green burst accent. There's enough cues there that within the category to tell you it's still spearmint because of the green and white burst, but it differentiates itself so well that it will make you reframe the entire category. Mm. As Bruce mentioned earlier with Tide, that orange for Tide in that particular category is an anchor that makes you reframe the entire category. You'll go to it as a wayfinding spot to say, I found Tide, and that orange tells me I'm in that category.
Yeah.
Five Gum is almost doing the same thing now for Gum. It's making you relook at the entire category as a category captain.
So you have to be very careful to understand what the rules are and then play around the edge of them.
Absolutely. Design for design's sake isn't going to help anybody because you could throw so many things away.
I think the retailers are beginning to realize for their brand that it's important that they stand for something. And so the private label presentation within the store is actually an opportunity for them to deliver value against their brand to a consumer. Whether that is high quality product, an articulated strategy that goes from top to bottom, you know, low price to high price, or whether or not it's just something that saves someone money. I mean, that is a real opportunity for retailers to leverage private label in a fashion that delivers for their brand. Now, you've also got all the manufacturer brands inside of certain environments that are competing, but this is all the tension of what's going on in a retail store. It's actually the most exciting thing because I think that, you know, when you're delivering something tangible in terms of the brand, whether it's a product or a retail environment, that is the most significant moment in a brand and a consumer's life. And to be involved in that is just, you know, it's just fantastic.
It's quite interesting how, I mean, I was just out shopping over the weekend and noticed that in the store that we were in London, the own label, as it used to be called, the own brand, is now dominating the kind of eyeline level at most categories. They're pushing out the manufacturer brands either above or below that. And these are important places.
Yeah, your natural cone of vision, of course, is like right at a specific height. Mm. And when you get above or below that, it is definitely out of that space. That's why merchandising orchestration is so important. Like, generally what you'll see is like brand ribboning that runs vertically. So you get, you know, larger scale packages at the bottom, but you have brands that run from top to bottom. It's interesting, though, in the case of a private label manufacturer that they are starting to strike out with their own territory within a store. Could be, as you're describing, you know, a horizontal band that goes across all the categories, but it could also be where they're taking like a centerpiece or a side cap at the beginning and they're making their total own brand statement at that place, you know, and people are starting to go to those positions as they learn in a retail store where they're at, because it's a hidden asset for the retailer brand.
How do the manufacturers fight back against that?
Well, they have the advantage, I think, of, you know, in a lot of ways, of brand recognition. They've got the, you know, the opportunity to see this in so many different environments, whether it's through the media or other things. I mean, large manufacturers are driving those brands all the time.
I think there's also another component to this as well, as the private label as a brand now. It's no longer a dirty word as it used to be, and it's not, and even consumers have got wise to it. There's a good, better, best model even within there. There's a premium aspect to that. There's another future conversation, which is purchasing online. How are brands and private labels going to compete in that category? Mm-hmm. So there could be the journey to the store, but at the same time they may have done a different shopping purchase for commodity items online at home, so they could actually enjoy that 1 hour in the store, so they can really make a different connection with brands.
It makes for a very different composition of what you might actually have within a store as well, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
We've actually hypothesized that, you know, the if a manufacturer is in a commodity space, if you're in a merchandise realm that is of a stock-up or an inventory consideration, that it's a replenishment thing week after week after week, that does not add to the attraction of a shopping trip. Those kind of things are at risk, I think, to becoming truly product that can be distributed online, both to the customer satisfaction as well as the manufacturer's satisfaction. And I think it changes the dynamic about some of the things that we're leading the way with in terms of what packaging and how those equity elements of brand come to life for those types of online experiences. Because there's a theory that says that there's no reason that a bottle of detergent couldn't show up in a Kraft brown bag or a poly bag box with a label on the corner that identifies the brand. And you save the expense of the packaging to simply provide for the transportation.
It's interesting.
It could be a completely different dynamic that begins to occur in terms of subscription replenishment and some of the sophisticated tools that are out there in terms of knowing just exactly when you need something else.
Mm. I mean, certainly I know through direct experience that a lot of the online retailers, their systems are smart enough to work out the frequency at which you use things, you know, so they know that you get through a pack of washing powder every 3 weeks, so they remind you if you haven't bought it.
And that starts to wrestle back the control from the consumer, or enters a far more even dialogue. If they know these things, you can then start talking about customization, mm-hmm. and a dialogue with that specific consumer, and you get back to the me versus the we conversation. And it also then talks an exciting moment about the difference in design. The role of pack on an online site is very different from the role of pack on a shelf, like Bruce talked about. But yeah. Then, how is it delivered? What's the ceremony of opening and arriving and taking it from the front door to wherever you need to place this thing? We call that the alcohol cabinet, if you will. All of the good expense alcohol is the front of the shelf,
right.
and the cheaper stuff is the back, because that's what you want to show off. But people do that for themselves as well. Mm. How are the spice rack arranged? How are the pasta boxes arranged? Even cereals. What's interesting is most cereal boxes in cabinets are stacked side on. But
yeah.
We talk about face on. Well, actually, the primary delivery in the home is the side of the package, and we fill that with garbage information that is useless to the consumer. Yes, it needs to be there, but there's other. It can go on the bottom, for example.
Yeah.
The mandatory information with an online conversation and in the home conversation will change, and that makes it very exciting for everybody.
Yeah.
All of this sounds like there's an awful lot of information that you're bringing in. A lot of it is consumer insight and understanding. So research, I know, plays a big part in the way that companies, and indeed we work with companies in order to try and produce the best possible chance, the best foot forward for the brands that we work for. How do you use research, and what's your opinion of it? It's always quite interesting to talk to people who have the creative challenge, Fred. So you might want to kick off.
Well, I think that there's a role for having the standard research, you know, 12 consumers around a table showing flashcards. Mm. I think it has a role, there's a purpose, but quite frankly, it's an antiquated methodology. It becomes a beauty pageant, if you will. If you like the blue one or the bluer one, the big one or the bigger one. And they're more often than not, from the hundreds that I've attended, is that they'll tell you what you need to know. They'll tell you what you like to hear versus what you need to know, because consumers have become savvy to even that moment.
Yes.
And I think behavior is what you should really be looking at, because that's where the aha moments are. How does a consumer really engage with that product? What are they looking for, rather than a beauty pageant of images? And if you can really dive down into the psyche of the consumer from three journeys that we talked about, that will open the aha moments of the role of the brand in their life.
So you'd rather go and sit in my kitchen and watch what I do than have me come and sit in your viewing facility and look at pictures?
Well, it's not only, absolutely, but it's not only what we learn about that particular brand that we might be assigned to, it's the relationship from one brand to the next.
Right.
And if you think about categories then and the shopping.
And it's a massively artificial position that
absolutely.
You put people in, isn't it?
You can change everything.
Yeah, you just think about the retail experience across any number of categories. I mean, the amount of noise, the physical things that are going on, all of the merchandising messages that are coming at you, the product choices that are being presented, it's very difficult to simulate those kind of things in terms of people actually telling you what they're going to do as versus what they're actually going to do. So if you can create those types of really well thought through methodologies that put great research approaches together, you can get to the core of what people are going to actually behave like when they're in a retail environment.
An example that we've had on Shopalongs, it was by accident, it's not the brand that we're looking for, but we witnessed Housewives, air quotes, with a very well designed bottle of detergent on the sink. And of course we then have a dialogue about that particular brand, and lo and behold, every single housewife told us, well, actually the product that's inside there is a different brand. They really like the shape of the bottle, but they're actually using a different detergent to refill it because of the design. They were enamored by the design but not by the function of the product.
You know, the analytics that's used in this area is really quite far out there, isn't it?
All forms of information about the productivity of the environment, as well as how people are, you know, getting your message, because, you know, you can see things like results with private label merchandising strategies and how it's flowing through the cash registers with simple orchestration changes in the inside of the environment. And every store is not the same, you know, even though it might be one brand, A lot of sophisticated retailers are actually articulating their merchandise assortment differently in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, because, you know, there's regional differences. There's unique flavors. There's things that brands that are smart realize they have to tailor to local communities.
We've talked about the effect of the digital world and particularly looked at sort of online shopping in the process. What other things do you think might influence the future? And indeed, what are the things that kind of keep you, the two of you, awake at night in terms of how do we make sure that we stay at the cutting edge of what our clients need?
I think it's very exciting, actually, myself. I think it's a neat time. I don't know that we've seen this type of transformative moment in terms of how things are delivered to consumers in 100 years, maybe. And in a matter of speaking, the word store itself is a bit antiquated when you think about it, because the very implication of the word store is that I'm holding inventory. Right. And I think that in that context, those days are really coming to an end, because even physical retailers are figuring out how to have supply chain movement on their goods, that they're actually holding very little in place, and it's real-time movement of goods through their environment. But the real truth is impact on digital and online replenishment comes to the forefront. And people, any product with a serial number, I think you need to think that through, because a part number, to Google that, I mean, you'll get, you know, 1,000 pings right now on where the best price is on that. I think that it puts pressure on both those people that are making unique products and really wanting to get something out there that can stand the price pressure of the world, you know, something that's so appealing that people will pay more for it. But I also think it puts pressure on the retailers themselves to make more in-tune environments, more in-tune merchandising assortments, more significant and meaningful contributions to people's lives. Because if people are time poor, and people are time poor, the retailer that provides for the most effective and transformative experience in retail, and that might mean smaller, tighter, better, quicker, less superfluous stock up.
Well, I think if you look at it through the traditional lens, and why it's so exciting right now is the packaging brief, so in very simplistic terms, always came at the end of a large initiative. You know, it was, we've done all of this, and uh-oh, the packaging is now out of date. What we're noticing now with our smarter clients that are bringing in more of a holistic view, so packaging is actually the beginning of a project. And not just about the packaging agency, in, you know, air quotes, but bringing in all of the media. Partners.
It really is
time.
About understanding the brand.
Absolutely, and put the brand, put literally the packaging on the center of the table and say, we all have a responsibility to deliver that. And you can get the retailer involved in that conversation early on as well. Here's our intention, this is how we're going to support it, these are the things we're going to do on your behalf, this is how they're going to navigate it, here are the component parts. Then all of the agency partners are then playing off the same song sheet, versus egos coming into it where somebody's just hell-bent on winning a design award for the sake of a design award. Well, that doesn't do anything for the brand, it doesn't do anything for the consumer. Because when you add digital into that, the journey has changed. Mm-hmm. And brands that can't understand the fact that the consumer has changed, the journey has changed, that's what the future is about. So rather than decorating.
Fred, Bruce, a fascinating conversation. Thank you very, very much for taking the time. And, you know, better get out there and make sure that we do all this stuff, right? One thing that's for sure is that times of difficulty tend to lead to innovation. And it seems pretty clear to me that we are bound to see, indeed destined to see, some very interesting changes happening in the world of retail over the next few years. I would say that the clue, ironically, to the future of retail lies in digital. Digital provides the opportunity to create the kind of seamless experience which links together everything from that moment when we're starting to write our shopping lists that Bruce talked about, right the way through the store experience and through to home usage perhaps too. It is the opportunity to create another red thread around a brand, quite simply the red thread of experience. But at the end of the day, we're still human beings. We love to see things, smell things, taste things, and touch things. And retail stores, grocery stores, fashion stores, whatever they may be, are still a wonderful sensual experience for us as human beings. This was Demand and Desire. I am Jez Frampton, Chief Executive of Interbrand, and I look forward to spending time with you very soon. Thank you very much for listening.